Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we have Emma Smith with This is Shakespeare.
Thanks a lot for being here. I'm going to be talking about thinking with Shakespeare in historical context, and perhaps slightly riskily, given that I'm at a history festival. I'm probably going to be saying it's quite hard to think about Shakespeare historically, and maybe there are some reasons that that's not the best way to think about Shakespeare. I'd reiterate the point about questions, so do be thinking as I go through about things you would like to ask, either things you want me to go back over or things you want to check out or argue with. What would be great for me to know right now is what are the Shakespeare plays that you might have been studying, say, during this last academic year, because then I can use those for my examples rather than talking about plays that you don't know. So can anybody just shout out? Macbeth? Hamlet, Othello, Measure for Measure, Taming of the Shrew. God, you've been having a cheerful time, haven't you, all of you? A Midsummer Night's Dream. Any advance? I heard some muttering, but Antony and Cleopatra. Titus Andronicus, my God. Are we just now naming all the plays we can think of? Okay, excellent. That's really helpful, thanks. Probably brings out one of the points that I'm going to come to is why do we think tragedies are more important than comedies and how might that relate? Okay, so what I'm trying to think about this morning is the question of Shakespeare in historical context. If you're doing A-level English, A-level English literature, you're almost bound to have to think about Shakespeare in context. And what I want to try and do here is to suggest some of the difficulties about that, I hope in a useful way, so you can think a bit more creatively about the kinds of context you want to put Shakespeare in. And if I've got one aim, it's to change one word in the phrase that we often use. So I think we often say Shakespeare mirrors his society. We use the word mirror to suggest that there's a sort of direct equivalence between Shakespeare and his own world. And I want to change that word mirror to something with a little bit more fight in it, maybe challenges or redraws or ignores or negotiates or something like that. That's the thing I want to think about. So I want to think about a relationship between Shakespeare and his own world, which is not just a direct mirroring. And maybe I can help you see what I mean there by thinking about a more modern parallel. Let's imagine we are the literary historians of the future, say 400 years from now. And let's say we have a certain number of cultural artifacts from which to deduce our understanding of early 21st century Britain. Let's say we've got Avengers Endgame, Fortnite, The Great British Bake Off, Wallace and Gromit, possibly Killing Eve, maybe just Series 2. So we've got this collection of slightly random things that don't all fit together. They're all more or less from this period. They're not all enjoyed by the same kind of people. And we can see that if we were to try and deduce back from them, what was it that people did in the 21st century? What did they look like? What were they interested in? We'd get quite a weird back projection. If you were to understand, for example, the importance of Twilight as a text for young people in the 21st century, and to deduce back from that, everybody in the 2000s believed in vampires, you can see that that would be ridiculous. But nevertheless, we do sometimes deduce back from Macbeth's witches, an idea that everybody at the beginning of the 17th century was superstitious and believed in witches. So those are some of the things that I just want to kind of nudge a bit. We know, that's to say, that our own cultural productions, our films, our novels, our TV series, we know that they have a relation to everyday life, but that for most of us, we enjoy them because they're not everyday life. They're not the world that we actually live in. They may be escapist in one way, they may be idealized, they may be futuristic or fantasy. There are lots of different ways in which cultural entertainment doesn't directly reflect the world that produces it. And I'm going to suggest that that's one of the ways we ought to think about Shakespeare. So I've got four kind of precepts or ideas that I want to talk round. And the first one is Shakespeare does not write documentary. Okay, Shakespeare does not write documentary. One of the things that's hard for us to understand, because most people now wouldn't read Shakespeare unless they were made to by the oppressive school system, and wouldn't go and see Shakespeare performed unless it was subsidised by the tax system. It's hard for us to understand a period when Shakespeare was high popular entertainment. What we know about high popular entertainment now and then is that its primary purpose is to make money. Its primary purpose is to please and develop audiences so that they keep coming back and they keep paying. Now, that's a consumer system, an economic system, which produces wonderful art. Don't think we should feel ashamed about that, or that that's somehow grubby, or that's not what art should be about. All art is produced within economic contexts. We sometimes idealize it with the idea that somebody is just sort of in their garret producing this wonderful stuff, but that doesn't really happen all that much. So Shakespeare's writing entertainment, and he's writing the things that his audience wants to see, and he's not writing, and what they want to see is a kind of more fairy tale or escapist view of the world. Shakespeare never sets a play in contemporary England. He's not interested in that kind of realist world. All his plays are in a sort of never-never land, either the never-never land of the past, the medieval past, the classical past, or the never-never land of a sort of European world of fairy tales. Even a real place like Venice, in The Merchant of Venice, is not a real place for Shakespeare. He's certainly never been there. That could take place anywhere. What matters is that this is far away from London. This is not your everyday experience. Okay, so Shakespeare is writing plays which are deliberately at a distance from people's everyday experience, because that's what they want to go and see in the theatre. And so related to that, we might think about the way Shakespeare's plays sound. Nobody ever talked like that. Okay, nobody ever talked in iambic pentameter. Nobody ever talked in those huge long speeches. Nobody talked with that density of allusion and kind of literary figures and all that stuff that you spend all the time sort of trying to work out and pin down in class. Nobody ever spoke like that, and I think actually nobody ever really understood it either. That's to say, I think Shakespeare's language was a pleasure to people who went to the theatre for reasons other than what it actually, what every word actually meant. Sometimes I think it's a little bit more like listening to music or something like that, going to a rock concert, going to an opera, going to a musical. You can recognise the you can recognise the mood, the changing tone. You can trace the narrative. But what's important, really, is the overall a kind of sensory experience of hearing this language. It's not about what every single word means. So all these ways in which Shakespeare writes for a particular theatre and for a particular theatre-going public are things that mitigate against him writing directly relevant work for his own period. People don't want to see the truth about their own world any more than we do on television now. We don't want to see gloomy works about the death of the planet or all the kind of political corruption that's around us. We'd much rather see idealized narratives where people can put things right, people can narrative arcs where things actually improve or can be resolved. And I think that's pretty much true for Shakespeare's plays too. So there are certain obvious things in Shakespeare's plays that are not directly relevant to his own environment. There are more people who cross-dress in Shakespeare's plays, who dress in the clothes appropriate, traditionally appropriate to the opposite gender, than I think there probably were in early modern London. So I think it was more common to see a woman dressed as a man in the theatre than it was to see a woman dressed as a man in the street. I also think that probably people would accept and enjoy the kind of the erotic or the narrative or the just the plain comic possibilities of that scenario, a woman dressed as a man on the stage, when in the street they might have beaten that person up. And we know that's still the case, that people will accept things in entertainment that they don't actually accept in everyday life. If you were to look at RuPaul or something, you would think, my God, what a kind of open-minded society this world is. But if you were to live the experience maybe of a person who is trans or something, you would have a very different view of that. Okay, so Shakespeare's not writing documentary, but he's writing entertainment. Related to that, I think, is where Shakespeare gets his plots and his stories and his characters from. If any of you do creative writing now or are interested in writing your own stories, you might have been to some kind of workshop about creative writing. And one of the key pieces of advice writers tend to give starting writers is write about what you know. So write about what you have experienced. Bring yourself into your writing, because that will give it authenticity. That means that you can speak with a voice which is convincing. If you had been to a creative writing course in 1600, they didn't really exist, but let's just imagine they did. If you had been to that creative writing course in 1600, the advice would have been different in one really significant way. What you would have been told was, write about what you have read. Okay, write about what you have read. The whole of the Tudor education system is based on reading and rewriting what you've already read, rewriting established stories. Your example of Antony and Cleopatra almost certainly comes from a classroom exercise where grammar school boys, like the young Shakespeare, are asked to imagine a well-known story, perhaps from a different point of view, or to rewrite it in a different form, or using a different kind of poetic meter, or to translate it from Latin into English, or from English into Latin. These are all methods of learning which prioritize sort of facility with rhetoric and with the ability to express things well over the ability to invent things, okay? And they certainly don't suggest that the best material for writing is your own experience. They absolutely reinforce that idea that how you know someone is a writer and how you know that you should take them seriously is because you can see the traces of great writers from the past in their work. So they're not even trying to hide it. In fact, you mustn't try and hide it, because then it might look as if you hadn't read the stuff in the first place. So showing that you know Homer, showing that you know Virgil, Ovid, Petrarch, Dante, these figures from the classical past and these figures from medieval European literature, is a really important calling card if you want to be a writer in Shakespeare's time. And you'll know that's true from the Shakespeare that you're doing. Those of you doing Measure for Measure, that comes from a source play called Promos and Cassandra, where Promos and Cassandra are the Angelo and Isabella figures of that play. It's very closely shadowed on that play, and it may be significant that Promos and Cassandra, the source play for Measure for Measure, is in two parts, a kind of comic part and a tragic part. And that might help us think again about why is the genre of Measure for Measure so weird, or so, to use a technical term, so uncertain. If you're studying Macbeth, I think you can say Macbeth in a tent, surely nothing really bad can happen in a tent. Or maybe it's already happened. if you're thinking about Macbeth, Macbeth comes almost entirely from Holinshed's history of Scotland. What Shakespeare has done has been to mash together a couple of stories about different ambitious queen figures to create Lady Macbeth. And he's also telescoped time and action to make a more thrilling kind of roller coaster play. In doing that, he's actually taken out the times when Macbeth is described in the historical chronicle as a good king, which is for quite a long period of his rule. We don't get that in Shakespeare because he wants to do something different. But these are all to say that Shakespeare writes essentially drawing on other sources. Usually the borrowing from the sources is so close that he could only have had the work open in front of him as he wrote. It's not even about sort of internalizing and remembering and then reusing, although sometimes that does seem to be the method. What Shakespeare is doing is drawing really closely on previously published work and using that as the narrative scaffolding, but also sometimes the kind of character architecture of his plays. What that means also is that these stories are not really necessarily all that closely about the end of the 16th or the early 17th century. If you borrow your story plot from the Odyssey, if you borrow it from 14th century Tuscany, you know, if you borrow it from one of these previous stories, you import along with that borrowing a whole lot of assumptions which are not really the assumptions of your own day. We might think of that in terms of Shakespeare's female characters, for instance. So quite often when we're thinking about Shakespeare in historical context, we might want to compare the way Shakespeare presents women with attitudes to gendered behaviour in early modern England. I think that can be interesting and useful, but we also need to remind ourselves that for many of us, many of the women here in the audience, we might look at entertainment, we might look at Hollywood film, we might look at all kinds of things that are presented to us and think, my God, that's not really my life. You know, that's not the way I could never get my makeup like that, or that's not my world in which I, you know, have this kind of beautiful apartment in, you know, Los Angeles or whatever. We know that the representation of women in contemporary fiction is a problem. We know that we are worried when every TV detective series starts with a naked female corpse, because this seems to tell us something about the way women are being represented, which doesn't chime with how actual women see their experience. So we might want to take some of that knowledge, as well as the knowledge that Shakespeare imports this material from the past, to question whether a woman like, say, Lady Macbeth, or like Tamora in Titus Andronicus, or even like Desdemona in Othello, in what way do we think a woman in the audience at Shakespeare's theatre might have looked at that person, that character on the stage, and thought, yeah, that's just like my life. I really relate to that. That's just exactly how things are for me. I suspect not all that much. And that gap may be a gap in which we can think again about Shakespeare in historical context. And just thinking about that idea about women, I think it's helpful to remind ourselves about the theatre for which these plays were performed. We are used to television and film with the dominant mode of realism. We expect things to look consistent on television. If there is a empty water bottle on the, or a Starbucks cup in the scene in Game of Thrones, even though we know Game of Thrones is made up and that it is filmed by people who almost certainly drink coffee from Starbucks, if there is a coffee cup from of Starbucks in frame in Game of Thrones, it's completely spoilt the illusion. We want realism, we want it to be consistent, we want to feel that we are being transported into a consistent fictional world that works absolutely realistically to try and convince us that it's true. That's a million miles from the Elizabethan Theatre. If you've been to the Globe on Shakespeare's Bankside, the rebuilt Globe, you'll have a sense of this. If you haven't been, try and have a go. Try and go down over the summer holidays. If you don't want to go to a play, which I think still costs £5 to stand up for a play, you can certainly go and look around. You can go and look around, and what you will see is an outside theatre space with a yard where people stand, the so-called groundlings, surrounded by these galleries in which wealthier people and people who don't want to be with other people, like the people who pay for priority boarding and that kind of people, they pay to be further away from the action and further away from the people. That's a different model of theatre audiences from now, where you pay to be right up at the front. In the Elizabethan audience, you paid to be a little bit away from everyone else. But you can see two really important elements to that theatre. One is consistent lighting. And by that I mean the audience and the stage all exist in daylight. These are performances which take place in the afternoon. There are no technological techniques to black out the audience or to highlight particular characters on the stage. So lots of the techniques we use in the modern theatre, like spotlighting, or like that moment when the lights go down and we all have to be quiet and there's a recorded message that says, turn off your phones. Just that sense, it's all started and we need to be in theatre mode. That's not really present in the Elizabethan theatre. You might, if you think about drama from other periods, you might think about the so-called fourth wall. The fourth wall is the imaginary wall between the actors and the audience. And it's supposed to be a tenet of realist drama that actors don't break the fourth wall. That's to say, they don't talk directly to the audience. If you know about the fourth wall, or if you've just heard about it from me, forget it again immediately, because it's absolutely not relevant to the Elizabethan theatre, which doesn't have the first, second, or third wall either. Well, perhaps it has the first, it has a wall at the back. But otherwise, it has a stage which is open on all sides, where audience members are right up close, and where every view in the house, every single view in the theatre, has as much of the audience in it as it does of the stage. It's impossible in this theatre to forget you're at the theatre. And even if it were impossible, one of the great techniques of this theatre, particularly by Shakespeare, is to keep saying, we're in a theatre, aren't we? Life's a poor player that struts and frets his hour on the stage. All the world's a stage. If this were played upon the stage now, I'd condemn it as an improbable fiction. These are all moments when characters in plays say, I'm just like an actor on the stage. And you think, well, you are an actor on the stage. It's Hamlet's big problem, isn't it? And you know, one of the things we sometimes talk about in Shakespeare's plays is the difference between illusion and reality. I think what Hamlet understands is that even reality, sorry, this is a bit existentialist, but even reality is illusion. The real Hamlet is just pretending to be Hamlet, and the play is completely preoccupied with the pun, the serious pun on acting, meaning to do something, and meaning to pretend to do something. I think that's Hamlet. If I had to sum up fortune cookie style, Hamlet's dilemma, I think that's what I'd say. So I'm trying to give you a sense that the Elizabethan theatre is not realist, and let's come back to the women. You'll remember that all women's roles in this theatre are played by men. Often, I think, sometimes really good ones. And clearly, the ability to perform male roles changes over Shakespeare's writing lifetime. I think that the example of Cleopatra, for example, or perhaps of the Duchess of Malfi, if any of you are studying that too, these are late plays late in Shakespeare's career, so in the early, the first century of the 17th century, the first decade of the 17th century. What they seem to suggest is that there is a really good new actor who can convincingly play mature women. because the tendency before Midsummer Night's Dream might be an example, Taming of the Shrew might be an example, those early comedies. What we seem to get there is young women who are on the edge of being married and who often are playing off a kind of androgyny or a kind of asexuality in some way. But all those parts are played by men. I don't think that makes them like a kind of pantomime or like a caricature necessarily, but I think it might be another intermediate kind of element that makes Shakespeare's audiences recognise that where they are is in a fictional space. They agree to be in this fictional world. They are not seeing the world as it really is. They're in the theatre, certain things can happen there. The whole point is they don't happen outside. It's not the same world. So the Elizabethan theatre then is not primarily realist. Okay, so I've had my three points, which were that Shakespeare doesn't write documentary, that he draws on literary sources more than real life, and that the Elizabethan theatre is not primarily realist. And I just want to finish with my sort of final suggestion, which is actually the history that matters when we are thinking about Shakespeare is actually the history of the present. Okay. So Shakespeare, almost uniquely among writers of his period, but actually among writers in English anyway, has had a continuous afterlife long after his physical death. So Shakespeare's plays have been in more or less continual cycles of performance and reinterpretation, of adaptation and rewriting, and of editing and publishing in book form. That's to say, if Shakespeare was relevant or was speaking directly to his immediate audiences, if he was topical, or you know, if he was documentary in any way at the end of the 16th and into the 17th century, that's a long time past now. What's overlaid on these plays is a whole history of different reinventions. And we could look at those at any point. The job that Shakespeare does for Victorian society at a time when the Bible is looking like less of a guide to life because of Darwin's discoveries about evolution, we see that the Victorians really put Shakespeare as the sort of secular book that can explain everything. We can see that in the it's hard not to be a bit preoccupied by the war, isn't it, with all these tanks outside. We can see that in the during the Second World War, accounts of Shakespeare's history plays were really preoccupied with the idea that they were heading towards a peaceful future, even though the history plays, none of you called out names like this, but like Richard II or Henry V, the history plays are all about political upheaval and they're all about war. Every one of them seems to be about bloodshed and turmoil. Nevertheless, and perhaps because of that, a really strong interpretive framework was established which said, don't worry, Shakespeare is on the side of peace, and so are these plays. And you can see why that played an important role beyond what we think about Shakespeare. So I would say to you that in thinking about Shakespeare in context is not necessarily only thinking about the context in which Shakespeare wrote, but it's thinking about the context in which Shakespeare gets reinterpreted and adapted now. Sometimes I hear people studying Shakespeare disavow one of their own interpretations by saying something like, well, perhaps this is just a modern point of view, or perhaps this is just what I think because I'm a sort of 21st century feminist, or I'm a Marxist or whatever. I don't think you should disavow those, because I think the point of Shakespeare, the reason that it is worth studying Shakespeare, the reason that we keep reperforming and adapting these plays is precisely because of the space within them that we need to fill in with our own history. There are things that we can think about Shakespeare now. There are things about gender and sexuality. There are things about race and ethnicity. There are things about politics, which were probably unthinkable to Shakespeare. And that doesn't matter. In fact, that's absolutely the point. So the final of my points about Shakespeare in a historical context is the only history that really matters is ours right now. Thank you.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.